I'm Christopher Lydon, back in the pub with the quick draw political economist Mark Blyth, the smartest guy in Glasgow or the Ivy League, and our first candidate to replace Dominique Strauss-Kahn as director of the International Monetary Fund. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. So many important things we didn't know, Mark, about Strauss-Kahn, leaving aside apparently his life as a sexual predator. The good guys in Europe say he was a good guy in the banking game.
Well, he wasn't a bad guy.
But he was the friend of the poor countries.
Well, no. Let's put this
Portugal, Greece.
The friend of the poor. Basically what that means in the European context is your friend is the one who comes around and puts his foot on your neck, takes money out of your pocket and tells you to bring more money next week. That's what austerity politics is doing in these countries. So if that's the good
guy. A bad guy just shoots you.
I don't know who the bad guys would be. They would basically just have to shoot you or something. He was a good guy in the following sense. Okay. So the IMF, let's focus on this. The IMF basically should have went out of business sometime in the 1970s. Why? Because it was set up back in 1947 to police a series of fixed exchange rates as part of the Bretton Woods arrangements. Those ended in 1971. And it's a bit like the March of Dimes. So, you know, these guys, they cure polio and they're like, what do we do next? And then they go do something else. Well, that was like the IMF. Basically, it's like, well, we used to police this series of exchange rates and now they're gone. What do we do next? And the idea was that, well, we do all this kind of data gathering stuff. So we can provide countries with the information that we can kind of police them by doing surveillance over them. Mm-hmm. So they became the world's sort of surveillance cop for exchange rates and interest rates and all this sort of good stuff. So they did that and that's what they did. But then they also had this thing that they did to the third world called structural adjustment, part of the sort of the whole neoliberal way of thinking, which was, well, you know, governments are by definition inefficient, so what you need to do is basically cut them down to size, cut your budget, privatize kind of austerity for the third world. And it was pretty much an unmitigated disaster. After about doing this for about 15 years, even the IMF began to notice and they began to change their tune. And lo and behold, you know, when there was a huge banking crisis that didn't happen in a periphery country to someone unimportant in the developing world, they didn't actually cut all the budgets and they didn't jack up interest rates. They discovered Keynesianism again and they flooded the world with even more money and saved the banks. So it was the IMF that was doing that for us. So we thought he was a good guy because he basically saved our bacon. He then joined the chorus to say that now that we've saved the bacon, we need to cut back on the fat, hence the turn to austerity politics. But the French and the Germans like him because their own political leaderships are rather weak in comparison to the ones that were the guys who brought Europe together, Mitterrand, Kohl, etc. Merkel is no Kohl and Sarkozy is no Mitterrand. And provided, if you will, a fulcrum, a focal point, someone who could speak to both sides and basically bring them together so that Europe could have some kind of common policy as they went forward through the crisis. So he was a good guy in that sense.
Well, he wasn't going to push austerity over the cliff, supposedly, right?
That's right. He wasn't going to do that.
Is there a danger that somebody else will?
Well, if you take anyone from the ECB and give them the toys to the European Central Bank. Basically, the European Central Bank was set up with one target and one target only, fight inflation. It was set up in 1999 to fight an inflation that died in 1983. So they've been very successful at that and they've continued to do so. So even if the economy is flying off a cliff in a deflationary manner, you know that these guys will be first in the fight against inflation. So yeah, there are worse out there, certainly.
Between the lines, and they don't write it anymore, is not the euro still in a horrific crisis, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we spoke about this, I think, the very first time I was on here.
But has anything been done?
No, nothing's been done. The entire political apparatus of the EU and the countries that make it up are playing a game of kick the can down the road and hope that it fixes itself. Because there's no way to fix it. It's an institutional design problem. Well, I'll run through this very quickly again. So in 2008, everybody's doing great. Everybody's told themselves that we're all richer, smarter, happier than we are. And there's a huge banking crisis. We don't know what happened. Well, regardless of what happened, we've spoken about that. All the banks blow up and all this money has to be compensated in some way, whether it's through holding up the bank's balance sheets, recapitalizing them, adding liquidity, whatever program you want to do. But that means the government basically catches all that debt. This blows a huge hole in their debts. So their debt to GDP ratio goes from like 40% to say 60, 70, 80%. Suddenly the guys who hold sovereign bonds start to go, hang on a minute, we knew the Greeks were at it, but everybody seems to be in the hole now. I was paying you 4% on a bond when you were at 40%. Now you're at 70%, you need to pay me 6%. So the government just spent all this money bailing out the banks. And now it's got to give these guys, the bondholders, even more interest payments. Who are the only people with any money left? The taxpayer. Now, here's your problem. If you have a democracy, you can't squeeze people until they bleed, because they'll vote for someone who says no more squeezing. So at the end of the day, there's a face-off between the bondholders and the taxpayers. And just now, the taxpayers are getting squeezed in the name of austerity. But as we saw with the demonstrations in Spain and in Portugal and Greece, it is just a question of time until someone there says enough, because it can't work. They cannot grow and pay debts of this magnitude at the interest rates that are being demanded. It is actually impossible. But the Germans will continue to insist that they can, and they need to tighten their belts and so on and so forth. And they'll tighten their belts all the way until they die. But they won't, because they're a democracy. They'll tell the Germans to get lost. And when that happens, all the guys holding sovereign bonds go, "Oh, I'm out of here." And they dump the Greek bond, they dump the Irish bond, and it ricochets all the way around the European bond market until it hits Spain. And Spain has a $1.3 trillion price tag. The European bailout mechanism has $750 billion written on it. They've just told me how much money they're willing to lose, and it isn't enough to bail Spain. So all you need to do is kick the dominoes over until it reaches the door of España, and it's game up.
Where will we read that score? Game over. And what will it mean to you and me?
Well, I'm going to Spain on vacation in June. So every time I open up the Financial Times and I see Greek bond spreads at all-time high, contagion fears in Europe, I think to myself, oh, God, no, because I'm going on vacation. But ultimately, I've got euros stashed away somewhere. So it won't matter to me if I'm spending euros. Now, here's the, because it's domestic currency, right? But what it will matter to is if I'm spending dollars, because if the euro exchange rate effectively collapses, I can go there and with $5, I can buy half of Northern Madrid. So there's going to be huge effects of this depending on what assets you hold and what currency they're denominated in. The people who want to maintain the value of their assets, the really important players here, are the people holding sovereign bonds. Now, you think of these guys as like, you know, Machiavellian traders. They're not. They're pension funds. They were buying what they thought was a safe investment. And when we caught the banks, we, our governments, caught the banks, that safe investment became less safe. These sovereign bond guys also hold equities and other things in the portfolio to pay the pension that you expect to get 10 years from now. And they took a bath on that in 2008. So they want to buy something that's going to guarantee them yield. So they're going to insist that the government honor their debts. But the more they insist, the more the government squeezes the taxpayer, the more the taxpayer is eventually going to turn around and tell them to get lost. That's the collision.
So you should just stay out there on vacation, I think.
Oh, I think so. I should basically show up with like $100 and watch it appreciate in value. It is only a question of time.
It's amazing to me how little I know about this life or death question for the world. I mean, the meltdown is still melting down, is it not?
It is. It's like watching Fukushima. It literally is. So it's a really good analogy. It's interesting you mentioned that. I've never really thought of that. So Fukushima happens, and everyone goes, how could this happen? And after the fact, we can all explain it. They don't build the wall high enough, whatever. It's an institutional design problem. So then, oh my God, there's going to be a meltdown. And then they manage to avert the first catastrophic meltdown. But then there's another one. Then there's another one. And then it becomes kind of creeping meltdown. Right? Now it's not on the front page anytime, but they haven't solved the problem. But in a sense, we've gotten used to it. It's like a permanent crisis. And the Eurozone crisis has been going on for 18 months now. And we've gotten to the point where it's like, oh, yawn, another European crisis. Tell me something I don't know. Well, you know what? Eventually this thing gets to a tipping point. You don't know where it is. And then when that happens, bad things happen.
And meantime, Edna O'Brien, the novelist from Ireland, says, fresh back from meeting the Queen of England in Dublin, says, they've written off the next 50 years for the Irish people. I mean, this is sort of serious.
Yeah, it is. It's very serious.
50 years worth of damage ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if 50 years is right, but, you know, one bank, the Anglo-Irish Bank, which I believe is their second biggest, or it's not the biggest thing, maybe, whatever, one of the three big banks, is 50 billion euros in debt on a population of 3 million. I mean, just do the long division. I mean, that's huge. It's one of their banks. So the really interesting question, and this is, let's take Iceland as the best example of this. At least they had the sense not to guarantee their banks. They're still facing basically a 30% GDP hit to be, you know, amortized, if you will, over a 10-year period. They will survive. The real economy is rebounding. I'm quite confident in that because they weren't silly enough to guarantee the banks in the way that the Irish did. But at the height of the boom, the banks in Iceland, and they have four big banks, Their assets were worth 1,000% of GDP. So let's think about this. Four banks owed out collectively, therefore they had as assets on their book, the liabilities to everybody else, 1,000%, 10 times the net worth of the country. How did we ever get into a world where we thought that was a good idea? And we're all doing it. We haven't stopped. We haven't learned a damn thing since 2008. Wall Street's back making super profits. Why? Because they use super amounts of leverage. Why? Because we know they'll bail them. Now, this brings us back to should we have bailed them? And I'll go back every time with this. 300 million Americans, 500 million handguns, 72% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. Yeah, let the banks fail and you'll find out what it looks like to live in a Mad Max movie. We couldn't not bail them, but we should not have bailed them. It's a dilemma. You can't solve them both.
In the meantime, President Obama, speaking to both branches of Parliament, is crowing about the old Anglo-American leadership of the economic world, the dollar and sterling axis. He said, the time for our leadership is now. We remain the great catalysts for global action. Can this be?
Well, I think, you know, the United States is still 23% in the world economy, 65 to 75% of denominative reserves, 80% of commodities or thereabouts are denominated in dollars. Yeah, okay, Britain, let's really, you know, let's be serious about this. It's about 4% of GDP. It was the global empire that basically has sliding its way slowly and inexorably to developmental status. It's a huge banking conglomerate that has a leveraged bailout by the state on the tax-paying population. It's parked off the coast of Europe, and it makes money by being a hedge currency stuck between the dollar and everything else, particularly the euro. It's not in great shape. If you want to have a look at debts and get worried about debts, David Cameron's busy cutting the hell out of the government budget. Nothing comparison to the state debt is nothing comparison to private sector debt and financial sector debt in particular, and even consumer debt in Britain. Much worse than the United States when you control for head of population. So why is this guy flying all the way there? Well, it's on the way to the G8 summit, which is being held in Paris. So it's about time that he went to the Brits and patted them on the head. That's frankly what's going on. So he goes to the House of Parliament and he tells them what they want to hear, and everybody thinks he's great because he's not George Bush. So that's what we just saw. It's performance, it's theatre, it's utterly meaningless.
Wow.
So let me give you an analogy for this, right? Have you ever known a couple where there's like a really, really hot woman and a really ordinary guy? Which one do you think works harder at the relationship? America's the really hot woman. Britain's the really ordinary guy. It's so much more important for them to have the special relationship. The United States couldn't give a damn.
Mark, I just wonder who's dealing with the big picture of debt, not only the state debt, but the universal debt to China.
What universal debt to China?
Well, I mean, everybody owes China.
Yeah, so we own China.
Remind me.
Well, what are we paying them with?
Dollars.
Who prints the dollars?
Okay.
It's my currency, but it's their problem.
Are you serious?
I'm quite serious. I'm absolutely serious. What are the Chinese going to diversify out into? If the euro, here's an example as to why the euro's shot. If the euro was any good at all, China would have half of its reserves in euros. But if it did, two things would happen. Number one, it would take on all the currency risk and sovereign risk associated with that block, which isn't a real currency because it isn't a real country and it isn't a real unified economy with transfers and all the rest of it. So unfortunately, it's stuck in dollars. Now, it could declare the yuan, its own currency, a reserve asset, but then it would have to get rid of capital controls, and then it would have to be freely exchangeable and convertible and trade at market rates, in which case it would shoot up in value because everybody would want to hold it because it's the growth economy of the moment and the long-term punt for the future. So then what happens is the value of the currency goes up. And what happens to its exports? They go down. Now, given that Chinese income distribution makes the United States look like Sweden, that's great if you're that 100 million that have got German consumptive lifestyles. But if you're part of the 900 million or so that are basically living in abject poverty or marginally above that, then it's going to be a hard thing because you don't have the consumptive power to take up the slack for the exports declining. So they are sitting on dollars. So they could diversify out of dollars, except there's nothing to diversify into. They could stop exporting to us, but there's nowhere else to go because they don't have another business model. And it'll take them 20 years to make the transition. The universal debt goes the other way.
Mark, I'm always looking from you for a kind of 2020 vision. Looking back from just 9 years from now, what will we say about this moment, 2011, 3 years after the meltdown, when we had a warning, this can't go on?
Well,
where will we be then?
One of my favourite phrases is things continue until they don't. And if you know that they're not going to continue, then you have an informational advantage over everybody else. Now, if that was true, and I knew what that was, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be lying on a beach with three Victoria's Secret supermodels. So given that I don't have that information, I don't think anybody has that information, because that's not the way the world works. So if we can't really predict, why do we listen to predictions? Let me give you a bit of a roundabout way of thinking about this. A few years ago, nobody had ever heard the word BRICS. Then a guy at Goldman comes out and says, Brazil, Russia, India, China. What have they got in common? And he puts together this very simple model is based around exchange rates, consumption, demographics, and a thing called total factor productivity catch-up. So it's about how productivity over time changes and exchange rates change and how this intersects with demographics. From that, he makes a 50-year linear projection.
Hmm.
That is ludicrous. If anybody gives you a 50-year linear projection on anything other than your life expectancy, get out quick. Can you imagine if you did this 1912, right? You went to a bond guy at Goldman in 1912 and said, all right, I want a portfolio and I want to invest in sovereigns because I want low risk. I don't do companies. All right, fine. What would you suggest? Well, 40% of your allocation should be Britain. It's not as if they're going to spank half their national treasury in a pointless war in Europe, is it? Okay, what do you think the other one should do? Well, I would split it between Germany, emerging economy, fabulous place. I mean, it's not as if they're going to get caught losing 75% of GDP in a pointless war in Europe. And for the long term, Russia, because that's the real growth economy of the moment. And in 1914, you would have been left with toilet paper 2 years out. So you're asking for 2029 years out. Goldman's out there selling people a product based on a 50-year linear projection. All of it's useless. What can I say that I fear happening 9 years from now? We haven't learned a damn thing from the banking crisis. Dodd-Frank will basically put a little bit of a speed bump into the road and some airbags in the car. Other than that, the model remains unchanged. And because of that, we are now more exposed and more at risk than ever. Because there's no reason that this model won't go bang again. And the next time they do that, they won't be landing on public balance sheets with a 40% debt-to-GDP ratio. They'll be doing it with 80%. And that means there's no money to bail them next time. So when they go down next time, they really go down next time. Now, if you're a banker at the top of the game, if you're one of the guys in the top of one of these firms, you know that. Hmm. So what's your incentive? Is it to play nice? Is it to reduce your profitability? Is it to downsize your business? Or is it to go for broke before the whole thing goes up?
Whoa. So that's where we are. We're going for broke.
We're going for broke. We're not going to bankrupt ourselves because of the so-called profligacy of the state. Runaway state spending is a joke. It is not true. You just go, people bother to go to national treasuries and download the debt figures. Use the net figure rather than the gross figure. Look at the composition of the debt across financial sector, industrial sector, household, the whole lot. Mm. It is not. The American debt's no bigger than the German debt, yet they're held up as models of fiscal prudence. And we're somehow spending ourselves into oblivion. This is all politics by other means. What's going to get us once again is a credit cycle. A super boom followed by a super bust. Only this time we're doing it on really, really highly levered state and public balance sheets. That's the real problem. We're kicking the state, and the state is the thing that will save you. So we're kicking away the foundations of the building that we're relying on to protect us from the hurricane as the hurricane approaches.
Ooh.
It's beyond stupid.
Mark Blythe, we will do this again. Thank you.
My pleasure as ever to be the gloom and doom harbinger. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.